Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. The record reflects that it is 1:39 on Monday, April 22nd, 2024. Present at the committee table, we have Representative Josephson, Hannon, Galvin, Stapp, Representative Long, Ortez, Representative Tomaszewski, myself, Co-Chair Edgman. Expect to be joined by others here shortly. I'd like to ask that everyone please mute their cell phones if they would. The purpose of today's meeting is twofold. One is to hear from the Senate Capitol Co-Chair staff on the Senate's version of the capital budget. Mr. Grusendorf, who will be joining us at the table here shortly. I'd like to welcome Co-Chair Johnson and thank you for joining us. The second part of our presentation today will be sort of a recap or a summation from Lexi Pittman, Lynch Finance, relative to a more comprehensive fiscal update from where things stand, factoring in the operating budget that the House sent over, the Senate capital budget that came our direction, where do things stand, sort of the expenditure side of things, as well as the revenue side of things, and how does the big picture sort of look at that point. If not, any questions or comments from committee members, I think we should just jump in. Mr. Grusendorf, do you want to come join us at the table? And you know the drill. So welcome. I really appreciate you making yourself available. And we have an ample amount of time, I think, to give you a chance to sort of lay out your presentation, but as well have committee members ask you questions and sort of dig into the Senate's thinking in terms of putting their capital budget together. But good afternoon, and appreciate you being here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff for the Senator Hoffman and the Senate Finance Committee. With the chairman's permission, I will probably start off with what the Senate did with their first CS that came, we put on the table, and then move on to the additions that were made in our final CS. Our first CS was put out, and when we did this, the governor was at $302 million in his general fund capital budget. The six co-chairs had been meeting over time to come up with a scope and size of the budget, and part of that agreement was that the Senate would find $50 million to reduce from the governor's budget, so we took on that task. I'll just name off the projects that we reduced or deleted. The first one was the advanced commercial.
I jump in. What list are you?
I do not have that in front of you. It's just it's part of the governor's original.
Yeah, let's just take a short a pause here at ease. I'd like to call the committee back to order. We do have a question before we get to back to Mr. Grusendorf, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And just a follow-up as to your previous question. So is there a document in here that I can look at in these opening comments that Mr. Grusendorf is going to be talking about?
Mr. Grusendorf. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I have an internal working document that I worked off of. But I didn't produce that for this meeting. Okay. I didn't actually produce it for when we brought out CS1 over on the Senate side.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think for the committee's understanding, our plan was to have Mr. Grusendorf start off as sort of a verbal, bigger picture look at things, and then turn to these two spreadsheets that we have in the folder in front of us all. And he will identify which one that we're on when he gets to that portion.
For the record, Tim Rusendorf again. So the first project we removed was from DCCED with the Advanced Commercial Investment of the Alaska LNG project for $4.5 million. The second item we removed it and we're sticking it in the operating budget. That's Alaska Travel Industry Association. That was $2.5 million. We removed from Department of Corrections the statewide security doors and windows for $2.2 million. Also from the Department of Corrections, statewide security perimeter fences and gates for $2.3 million. From DMVA, we removed the AMIA safety and security preparedness for $500,000. We also removed from DNR the pre-commercial thinning and boost for the timber industry for $3.5 million. That's a silviculture. From Department of Public Safety, we removed the Pilatus PC-12NG aircraft acquisition, $6.2 million. Department of Revenue, we removed the AHFC down payment assistance grant program, $25 million. And DOT, we removed the Copper River Highway Wood Canyon Bridge and Trails. We also moved the University of Alaska's archive to achieve R1 status. We removed that to the operating budget. We also pulled $4 million from the supplemental for the Dalton Highway and $1 million from the Renewable Energy Grants Fund. We moved that down from $5 million to $4 million. So that was the items we removed. We pretty much left alone the all the department's first and second priorities, but as we moved down the list and had to cut $50 million, those were the projects we chose that were chosen to be reduced.
So to put this sort of in plain terms, the governor's capital budget that came before the Senate Finance Committee had $302 million in general fund. The Senate trimmed it back by $63 million, and then built it back up to the 550 UGF that it is now, with some of that money still taking shape as the House puts its priorities in. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the Chair, Mr. Rusendorf, you said something about, I don't know, was it Department of Forestry or what it was, but there was some reference to a forestry project, which, of course, forestry is big enough in my area. Can you remind me what that project was?
Yeah, it was, let's see where it is. I'll get to it. It's the silviculture treatments and tree thinning. We actually added the majority of this project back. And when it came back, we reduced it from $3.5 million to $1.5 million general funds, but we added $2 million in timber receipts that were available. So they're about $500 short from when they originally were in. The administration came and asked and said that the governor had liked the project and wanted to see it remain, so we put that one back in. We also put back the Dalton Highway $4 million in the supplemental, so they're back up to $8 million. So those two items we replaced and put back in.
Thank you.
All right, so McHugh, Representative Galvin, Representative Staff.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Mr. Through the Chair, Mr. Dusendorf, I did not hear one of your line items, that the amount, and I assume these are highlights. Is that what you're sharing?
No, these are all the reductions.
These are all the reductions. Okay. Thank you. So I missed hearing you say what the amount is for the, I think you said Copper Ridge Trail?
Copper River Highway. Bridge and Trails. And
okay.
That's
$4.2 million. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair. I'm through the Chair to Mr. Gusendorf. So I heard the capital request for the university's R1, you said that was deleted, and then you said it was moved to the operating. So my understanding was I saw the operating budget from the other body came out. It had been removed from that as well, right? So I don't know if you were aware of that.
Yeah, I am aware of that. I think we're going to go, it's going to end up in conference committee. What we were planning on was using our university receipts for all $20 million at one point in the capital budget, but then we decided that we'll just, because this body moved it over to the operating budget, we would just deal with that subject in conference meetings.
Okay, thanks.
Additional questions? Not seeing any. Mr. Gusendorf.
So those were the deletions from the governor's budget. We added some back, and a lot of the stuff that we removed was, some of it was replaced. The $25 million we removed from the payment down payment assistance program. The Senate decided that, or over discussions, they thought that before people can go and get a down payment to buy a house, there needed to be houses available. So for almost all that $25 million plus some, we put back into the budget under new housing, new construction, new housing across the state of Alaska. So a high overview is of the additions that the Senate made. This budget adds $200 million in UGF on top of the governor's $250 million, totaling $450 million before the budget hits this body. Budget came in on time and within the agreed parameters of size and scope. Some of the highlights include $68 million to K-12 and the university deferred maintenance. Of that, $9 million was K-12 construction, the top two on the school construction list, plus some of the REA funds for the third school. $38 million went to the major maintenance schools, number 1 through 15 on the list, plus two projects for Mount Edgecombe, which they're ineligible to be on the school maintenance list, so we pulled that out of the Department of Education's priority list and took their top two projects. $26.5 million to the university for 1 through 6 off their major maintenance list. The budget includes $30 million for housing and weatherization, $15 million for life, health, safety, $9.7 million funding to leverage federal funding and grant writing and match money, $8 million to the Department of Transportation for Harbor Match Program and emergency funds to address state-owned harbor liability, $7.5 million for food security, and then $50 million in discretionary spending that the Senate majority put in. So I'll go down the list of statewide items. I can give you page numbers and line numbers if you prefer, or I can just go down the list of projects.
That would be the second spreadsheet that we have amongst us.
Yeah, the one that has the first line has the page line.
And it says Denali Commission Housing Program.
Yes, that's one of those, yes.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'll start with that list. On page 4, line 9, Denali Commission Housing Program, the Senate added $7 million. On page 4, line 11, the Iditarod Trail Committee, the Senate put in $750,000, which is half of their request. On page 16, line 16, the Skagway Ore Terminal Decontamination for $1 million of ADA dividend. Page 4, line 31, was the Mount Edgecombe Deferred Maintenance for $2.8 million. Page 5, line 4, school construction, the first two schools plus phase one of the third school is $3.9 million of general funds and $26.3 million of the REA fund. In the construction side of the school. Page 7, line 18, election voting booths, which was the governor's amendment for $250,000. Page 8, line 33, critical minerals mapping earth for $2 million general fund. Page 9, line 18, silviculture treatments and tree thinning, we added back the $1.5 million GF.
I'm waiting until you got to the very end that we could hit a pause before we got a question. Representative Hannon?
I'm trying to, through the chair, if these page numbers are to match the bill, then I got the wrong bill. They're not matching. And I'm just wondering if those page numbers, I took them. So the very first one threw me off, the Denali Commission, I don't find out, page 4, line 9.
This was the version that left Senate Finance. There might have been a technical amendment that got added on the floor that might have thrown these off. That's probably
Well, for now, if it works, we can get a presentation of these.
I have them, and they don't match the bill.
Okay, three things. All right, I'd like to call the meeting back to order, trying to sort out the various lists that we're working off and where those items are located in the capital budget that we have in front of us that came from the Senate Finance Committee. There are a little bit of, there's some discrepancies, but that we can smooth that out. The bigger picture is to go through the items.
Okay, I'll just skip the line and page. HFC weatherization, the Senate added 5 more million to what was already in place. The governor already had money in that. We added more. These next three items, we used the HFC dividend that was proposed for the down payment program that they had. We wanted to use all 17 million of that was in that item, put back into HFC where the money came from. So these next three items, the next one is HFC rural professional housing for 5 million. And then HFC housing and new construction for 7 million. So those three lines total the 17 million that AHFC originally had in the down payment program. Then the last one is the surface transportation program amendment that came in from the STIP. The governor gave that. We got that on the 2 days before we put this bill out on the table. So, All that amendment was added and approved. There was one of the governor's amendments that we did not approve, and that was the one for the permanent fund for their computer. I think you guys had some questions on that the other day. A little disappointed that after spending so much money on the program that ultimately didn't work at the end, they had to change. The issue was at the time what they used for a funding source, and that was the permanent fund dividend money, which would have taken money right out of each person's check of between $10 and $12. And we didn't really have time to discuss that a whole lot. So rather than approve that, we decided to just eliminate it and work with this body on what funding they would like to use. If they want to use the dividend fund, then that would be a discussion.
And to add to that, this it will be coming before the committee whether or not to accept the $7.5 million request that the Department of Revenue put forward to have an IT upgrade that would allow the dividends and other things to happen on time. And it was a last-minute request. I think it got the other body a little bit off guard. And it's something that I think we need to consider on this side because it does play an important role, and it's considered essential funds for the Department of Revenue. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, the last item that you spoke about, the Surface Transportation Program Amendment, that doesn't have any dollar figure. Does that mean doesn't have any fiscal impact, that amendment? It doesn't have any dollar amendment or dollar amount next to it, so.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. No, there's a dollar amount associated with it, but at the time we received that amendment and had to have the bill printed, and we didn't really have that number readily available at the time.
Okay.
So, but it's a substantial amount.
And I would just sort of flag that as another item. We'll get into more detail throughout as we sort of unravel, a pretty complex document. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm On the surface transportation program, one of the things that had been listed in the bill that caught my attention under surface transportation is something called civil rights program. It's between the Chinook Highway and Craig Pollock bike route. And I am wondering if you have any idea what $280,000 at DOT for civil rights program is in the surface transportation.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I do not.
Okay.
There was a lot of things that came out in that amendment, and that one didn't. We had been for a day and a half before we had to act on it.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't speak DOT, and that one caught my attention.
Other questions, comments? Did you have more?
Yes, sir.
Of course you did.
So all those ones I just mentioned, they were all in Section 1 of the FY25 edition, general fund edition. The next ones I'm going to go through were in Section 4 of the bill, the supplemental. So the next 10 items or so are coming out of the supplemental. The 2024 capital budget.
Tim, can I just sort of help set the stage by maybe kind of rewinding a little bit and having you explain what constitutes a statewide project? Maybe you can talk a little bit about the statewide lists and what in the Senate's determination led to a project to be considered to be statewide.
Through the chair, a statewide project is a project that typically isn't for just one community. It may be a region. I would say the ANTHC skilled nursing facility, although it's going to be housed in Anchorage, people come in from all over the state will come in and use this facility. So it's not just an Anchorage project for just the community there. It's more spread out. We have lists that most of you are familiar with, the school construction list, the major maintenance list, the renewable energy fund list. We did not, if any of those projects popped up, we did not jump the list to do them, even in our discretionary spending. There was some that wanted to add a university project or add a little bit to their school project, and we had to go back to them and say, no, that's jumping the list even with discretionary money. All the projects had to be in CAPSIS, and as far as the regional, I mean, there are some things that don't appear to be regional, and either they were something that was dealt with when we came up with the size and scope in that meeting, or they can be shown to be a regional, more of a regional project.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, and I mean, perhaps this is better off record, but I could be, it's a good teaching moment to explain the following. I understand why in the operating budget, there's sometimes an effort to show cuts, and therefore one might want to spend from the supplemental budget and so that, you know, the budget looks like it's reduced and arguably is reduced. But I don't understand the motivation to fund something in a capital supplemental budget. What does that mean? The governor can spend it 2 weeks faster than otherwise? Can someone explain why we do that?
Chair, Representative Josephson, the Senate has came up with a spending plan. And we work with this body and come up with a spending plan. And we kind of work backwards from the operating budget for this year. And we backed out all the numbers. We agreed on some numbers that we both have in our operating budgets or our bills that needed to be paid. And at the end of the day, to accommodate a $550 million, or in our case, a $450 million, capital budget, there was money in our budget to look back in 24. There wasn't any left in 25. We're going to be cutting the margin real slim in 25. this body chose to take a different route with the earning, not the earnings, but the, what was left from the 24 money, and change the waterfall on funds that were available. The Senate is intending on sticking with the plan and the budget that passed last year on the use of the waterfall money, and using, there was a surplus money in 24, there was $117 million that was surplus. There was one pot of money split, $143 million each, one going to the energy relief to go to the dividend, and the other $143 was supposed to go to the CBR. This body chose to put all that money, all three of those, into the dividend. The Senate is choosing to go with the plan that they had last year and that was passed and confirmed with, and putting the money in. That's why that money was available for the Senate to use in a capital budget, where the 25 money is going to be spent up in the state's operating budget. There's very little headroom there. 20 million maybe left.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, and then another way to think about it is that when we left here, we built last year's budgets, or the current budgets that we're in now, at $73 a barrel oil, and the operating budget had a language section in it. And I'm going to ask you, Tim, to help me out here, because I may misquote this, but that based on the surplus, anything higher than between $73 a barrel and 78, I think it was, 50% of that surplus would go to, in calendar year FY24, would go to the CBR, 50% would go to the PFD. Well, as we got to December of last year, 2023, the fall projection upped that $73 number to 76, I think was that right, 76? And the spring forecast took the 76 number and raised it to, I'm drawing a bit of a blank here, in the 80s, 83, is that what the number is? So that surplus that was projected based at $73 a barrel oil about a year ago now blossomed into about a grand total of $441 million using the spring forecast of oil. As Tim was saying, breaking it up into three buckets, $143 would go automatically to the permanent fund dividend, the second tranche, $143, would go to the CBR, and then the remaining surplus of $116 would be open to use for appropriations or savings, whatever we decided to do that. Those three tranches could actually continue to increase because the price of oil continues to rise up. And by the time the fiscal year finishes in June 30th, those numbers could be bigger and, you know, more generous in terms of their allotments.
All right, I'll start down the at additions to the supplemental budget. Housing Alaskans was given $6 million. The AFN Navigator Program, $1.5 million. AML Grant Writing, $1.25 million. AMTHC Skilled Nursing Facility, $15 million. The Blood Bank was given $1.5 million of their $200 million request. The Denali Commission non-federal match program that we did last year also, we gave $7 million. C-Share food security, $7.5 million. The school major maintenance list at $36 million. The Dalton Highway, which we talked about earlier in the supplemental, we added the $4 million back, so it's a total of $8 million as originally proposed by the governor. Harbor matching grants, $7 million. The University of Alaska major maintenance 1 through 6, $26.6 million. The Palmer Courthouse, $3.2 million. And the Stratton Building Acquisition, $2
million. And actually, if I could jump in, I think the Palmer Courthouse was $2.3 million. Maybe those numbers got switched around a little bit.
Oh, yes, $2.3
million. Yeah. Question, Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Edgman through the chair to Mr. Gusendorf. The AFN the Navigator program, that was for COVID relief funds, was it not, through the chair? For helping them figure out how to get COVID.
They used the general funds we gave them last year to leverage those funds and infrastructure funds to help they help some of the rural areas together and, you know, come up with a plan on how to be able to leverage federal funds for projects in rural Alaska, just like the Denali Commission and AML do it for more of the, for all across the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue.
That is it for the additions. And then, obviously, there was the discretionary spending of $50 million. Those projects fell with all. I can tell you that they all fell within their each of their allocations. They didn't jump the list, and they were, all the projects were in CAPS.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. I have a quick question on going further up on line 9. That's the critical minerals mapping earth. I wondered if you could just highlight what that is a bit more.
That was brought to us by the chairman who did the operating budget subcommittee for Department of Natural Resources. It was a project that was in the budget last year, and it was a three-year program, and they didn't get it funded this year, but it was something that the Department of Revenue or Department of Natural Resources wanted. We did find some money. That's where we found the timber receipts from, that the $2 million that we added back to the silviculture and tree thinning.
I think that's,
and so we kind of swapped general funds for the receipts.
Thank you. Through the chair, if I may, one quick follow-up. I know we were in discussion, I believe it was with the geothermal bill recently, and helping to support ensuring that we have resources. And at that point, I think I heard mapping something similar, and I just wasn't sure if this is related to that. Because there was mention in that bill of critical minerals, and well, maybe I'll get to do some research on my own on this. Thank you.
Well, I think the clarification, as I remember, Grossman Galvin, is that one of the governor's earlier supplemental bills had $1 million for those three positions that the mm-hmm. geothermal bill would create.
Right.
But the operating budget itself has $1 million, if I'm not mistaken. So you've got two buckets $1 million, and one of them basically needs to come out, and we can figure that out at the conference committee. That's how I understand. I don't think that this $2 million in any way ties back to the geothermal bill. I could be mistaken, but I don't think that's the case.
Okay. One further question then through the chair. I guess I'm trying to understand is this some sort of a infrastructure piece or need, or is it an operating, are we hiring people to do something? Is it contractual, or is it PCNs? It's just a little bit fuzzy to me, and I do appreciate that there is a lot of discussion and interest in looking at our critical minerals. I just wondered how it's placed in the budget.
Sure. The best of my recollection is that these people are already in place. There's no new PCNs for this ongoing project. It was started last year. It was funded last year, and it was a 3-year project, and typical capital project lasts about 5 years. Through the chair, there's one thing I should probably mention. I forgot. There was one more reduction from the governor's budget that I skipped over in my notes, and it was the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Rail Belt Carbon Capture and Sequestration Project. That was also deleted out of the governor's capital budget. It was $2.2 million of general fund match.
Did you, actually, I just got a note. I was just thinking of this, Mr. Grusendorf, the $5 million in drones that I think was once UGF and then switched to university receipts. Did you mention that? I might have missed it if you did.
I did not mention it. That is the way the governor proposed it to us. And
okay.
So we stuck with the governor's proposal.
Okay, I was mistaken then. All right, additional questions? we will be obviously getting into these details a lot more thoroughly and getting more familiar with various items. A lot to go over, a lot of items that, were taken out of the governor's submission, recognizing the way the capital budget comes together is that the governor has his priority items. Both the Senate and the House have their priority items. They're all sort of melded together as best we can do it. And as I think about it, and this might be a question for Ledge Finance, I think this is the first real capital budget discussion we've had in 5 years. I think the last capital budget note was in 2019, calendar year 2019, fiscal year FY20. So we haven't done this in a while. And we're all sort of getting back up to speed. Representative Galvin and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. And I really appreciate you helping us kind of orient around this activity that to me is new, but I didn't know that it's also relatively new for the committee at whole, at large. My question is around the grid money, the Alaska Energy Authority. I see it already on one of the pages, and I assume, and the way it was presented to us earlier was that it's in different pieces that ended up being the grand total of, I think it was 12 plus a 20, came to around 32. And I'm just double-checking that that is pretty much in the same space in terms of the number. Right now, I only see page 33, and I don't even know if you have the same bill that I do, but that's under the DCCED. It's at 6.9, which I recall was the same number. And I'm just double-checking that the other numbers are also roughly the same and equaling about what we would expect. I think it was 32 in all.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Of the 6.9 million that you just recited from FY24 ADA dividend, there was a reappropriation from 2012 AEA project for 2.2 million, and then this year's ADA dividend for 3.4 million for a total of 12.7 million. That is nothing changed there. We were told that this number plus the 20 million of bond authority they already had will cover everything they need to do to be able to maintain the project going forward and come back to us next year with a more solidified plan and see if they can make progress on it.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Grusendorf, on one of the forms we have here, it says other non-UGF items, and I frankly, there was a memo, and here I'm looking at the dock electrification AEA Ocean Ranger. I think this was a Whittier-related program. We received an email from DEC about sort of justifying the use of these funds or something, and it's sort of vague in my memory at this point. But what is your understanding of those dollars?
Chair, Representative Gilson, those dollars right now, because there's legislation in place that are in the building here that doesn't seem to be moving for the Ocean Ranger program. That money, that they're collecting that money and it hasn't been used. And the reasoning in the other body, in the Senate, we were talking about uses for that and having docked electrification, reducing the emissions from the ships while they're in port. And it was dock related for cruise ship industry. It seemed like a good use of those funds. AEA is kind of putting together, last year it was for Whittier, they're not quite done. So we'll finish up that project, and then whatever the next ones are that are ready to go, we'll potentially receive this money. I think Ketchikan's close. I know Juneau's really close. Skagway is getting pretty close also. So any of the ports that can bring power and have agreements in place to do that, those would be the ones that would receive the money. And it seemed like an appropriate use of the money while the Ocean Ranger program is not
Yes. Well, I'm just concerned, Mr. Chairman, that the 2006 initiative, I don't think this is what the voters intended. It's true that this will make Prince William Sound's air better. But I'm not an expert on this, other than that I sense the legislature allowed mission creep. and one of our allies in that, or sort of the instigator, was the administration. But I just don't know who at this point is very effectively policing cruise ship pollution. And I'm disappointed in that. Thank you.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I wanted to just address my friend, Representative Josephson's. I think this $10 million is a separate allocation for dock electrification than the memo to correct the $5 million, oops, we didn't have authority and we moved money, and that was Whittier. And that's not this. This is new money, and us saying up front, here's the money, here's where it from, not arguing whether it's the appropriate use from Ocean Ranger, but doing moving money from Ocean Rangers for two additional electrification. Last year, when that money was moved, it was moved from the wrong fund and now needed to be backfilled with Ocean Ranger monies because they didn't have enough money in the CPVC fund. Ship CSPV, yeah, the passenger part, not the Ocean Ranger tax, but that this is $10 million different from the $5 million for what Whittier.
Can I dialogue with my colleagues just for a moment? Just to
Josephson,
Representative Hannon, and perhaps we need further expertise. But is it your understanding then that this is $10 million of new money unrelated to the other issue? But it suggests to me that the industry is not paying its own way in terms of that we're sort of subsidizing this clean air project on behalf of them. Am I understanding?
Mr. Chairman, the state is still collecting a per capita fee from cruise ship passengers that goes into the Ocean Ranger Fund. That fund is not being used to do other cruise ship monitoring. And this is taking $10 million out of that fund to appropriate it to a different purpose, which is electrifying docks.
Thank you. Any questions across the other side of the table? Comments? Representative Quill?
Thank you, Chair Edgman. It's a kind of a small thing, but I was trying to remember the Stratton Building acquisition. I think it's in Sitka, I think. I thought they were selling the building. Now they're buying the building. How's that related to Sheldon Jackson? I'm confused about that.
That building was a part of Sheldon Jackson. It was a library at one time.
Right.
And lately it's been used to store like artifacts and things from Sheldon Jackson Museum that's right next door to it. Last year we put in the capital budget an appropriation to remodel that building for the court system. But this year, as right before we put this budget together, we received a letter from the courts and from the Department of Education that they signed an agreement that the building could be purchased outright. So the courts thought that was a better way to go for them rather than renting from the Department of Education the space that they weren't using and didn't use. That they would just buy it outright. And they already have some money available that we appropriated last year for renovation, which was a reappropriate from an old project that was in that house district.
Follow-up? So through the chair, I guess I'm confused. Right now it's storing documents and historical things, but now you're telling me that the courts need the building and they're going to buy it?
The court always needed a building to move into. They were willing to rent one at the time.
Okay.
And they may still rent some of the space out if they don't need it to the museum to store some of these artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I know. I mean, that the building was not being used as a library anymore.
Okay. And one more follow up. So is Sheldon Jackson being sold? Or with the library part? So it was Sheldon Jackson and Stratton. I thought there were two separate buildings. Sheldon Jackson was falling apart, so they moved everything into Stratton. Is that property being the Sheldon part being sold? Or maybe I have that confused.
No, the property, the building's being sold. The property's still on Sheldon Jackson, on their campus there.
Oh.
But it hasn't been used as a library, and the Department of Education purchased the building, and then it's no longer needed.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Edgman. Through the chair to Mr. Gusendorf, just real quickly, you mentioned that all the items on the statewide item list, those are all in capsis, correct? Yeah, a quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, so I assume it, maybe it's an individual ad, but I couldn't find the ANTHC skilled nursing facility on the statewide capsis list. So I don't know if you could provide that for me. I do see the letters of support for it. I just don't see it in the statewide list of capsis.
Through the chair, Representative, as a request from them, Senator Hoffman put that into capsis, and I also believe there was someone from Anchorage that also did. I believe there was an Anchorage senator that also put it into capsis for them. Actually, they uploaded it, and then senators can grab it and put it in on their list too.
Okay, thank you.
You might have been Representative Gray.
Yep, Senator, through the chair, Senator Dunbar was the other one.
Yeah. Additional follow-ups, Representative Stapp, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Thanks, through the chair. I do have a question, Mr. Gusendorf, about the deferred maintenance. In reading this, it looks like you said the first two schools that are on the list. Does that mean every school that needs maintenance they don't have to be on capsis. There's a different list, right, that's around deferred maintenance. And then it says part of the first phase one of the third school. My question is, are we getting to all the schools that have buckets in their main entryway? Is this kind of getting to the most difficult ones, or are there a lot more difficult ones? I don't know how many are on the list in all.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the list is pretty extensive. No, on school construction, we are barely touching the list.
Okay.
Let me see. I have 19 projects totaling $395 million worth of total projects. And the state share is $260 million. So we're not, I would say that the list isn't being, we aren't going down very far on the construction.
Mm-hmm. Does the list tell you where student learning space is impacted so that one, for example, has to have, I'm not sure how that's delineated so that you're able to, is that decided by deed then, and they help you to articulate the order?
Chair, Representative Galvin, yes, deed puts the list together. They all the districts put in their requests. They adjudicate them. They rank them, and we don't choose or pick which one. We go straight down the list.
Understood. Thank you. And then I have one other line of questions. Thank you, through the chair, for your generosity. It's about the AHFC funding that is now, instead of the $17 million that my understanding was, that was going to go to help mid-range income level Alaskans have an opportunity during this point in time where the rates are so high to be able to have help or assistance in that down payment. And so instead of that, we're doing weatherization, rural professional housing, and housing new construction. And I was just thinking about the difference in terms of if this has been considered, like how many more Alaskans will we be housing, spending the money this way as opposed to the other way, if they've done that research.
I don't know if they've done that research. It was a $20,000, I think, to get your down payment.
Mm-hmm.
But the houses are so expensive, I don't know how far that would get folks. And it really probably, probably left a lot of Alaskans out of being able to get that. And I think by building housing and new construction, I think we've been told over and over again that that is a big need in this state, all across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought before people can even get a down payment, there needs to be something to buy this at a reasonable price.
One last question on that specific line.
Before you get to that, mm-hmm. just a reminder that we have a hearing tomorrow on school major maintenance and construction.
Thank lists, you.
So we'll get much more into detail on that.
Great. And on the housing piece, specifically the $5 million on new housing, is that going through the organization called HAP, I believe it's called? And they think they asked for that amount of money, and they work on making sure new units come in to line. Is that?
To the chair, Representative Galvin. Yes, it is going to HAP, and I believe it's half of the request.
Okay.
I believe they requested $10 million. They received $5 million from the Senate.
Thank you very much.
Well, I don't see any more questions or comments. And Mr. Gusendorf, I think you finished your presentation. So with that, I think we'll conclude part one of today's hearing and take a short break here as we transition to Ledge Finance. Tim, thank you once again for appearing before the committee, and we'll take a brief at ease. I'd like to call the committee back to order.
We got our second part
of our hearing today, which is to get a fiscal update from Ledge Finance. Mr. Painter, if you would come to the table, please. Your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So I'll be providing an update of where we are with the House passed operating budget and the capital budget that the Senate passed to this body, and where we are. So we're going to start with FY24. And I apologize in advance that this presentation is a lot of numbers. But I think the goal is to get everybody to see how we built to where we are in this session and where that place is. So we're going to start with the UGF revenue for FY24, just shy of $6.6 billion based on the spring forecast, Department of Revenue forecast. So the first things are the budget, session law 2023. So this is the budget we passed last year. The budget we passed last year, operating budget, capital budget, PFD and fund transfers added up to just over $6 billion. So based on just those appropriations, not including the energy relief, we would have a surplus based on the new forecast of $578.1 million in FY24. The budget last year for FY24 had a provision that split revenue that came in above the spring 2023 revenue forecast 50-50 between the CBR and an energy relief payment that will go out as part of the FY25 dividend. Based on the spring 2024 forecast a year later, the estimate is that we'll be $286.6 million above the spring forecast from a year ago. So that would get split up 50-50. However, this body's budget redirected the half that was supposed to go into the CBR last year into an additional energy relief amount. So instead, you see the 143.3 is an estimate, again, based on this year's spring forecast from last year. The 143 that was last year going to go to the CBR, now going to the energy relief. And then the House also added $116.5 million as just a firm number. The estimated surplus, as you'll see, kind of worked out to leaving nothing left in FY24, and then all of that going into energy relief. So in total, we'd estimate $403.1 million going into that energy relief, again, based on the spring 2024 revenue forecast that DOR produced last month. So after all of that's happened, there's $175 million left for supplementals in FY24. This body had supplementals in the operating budget of 121.7. The governor has also requested additional supplementals in the Department of Corrections that this body did not put in. Those total another $25.4 million. That includes an amendment the governor submitted after this body had worked on the operating budget. So it was an April 9th amendment of a couple hundred thousand. And then the governor also had some capital supplementals that, since they weren't in that budget, weren't in the operating budget, weren't included in your bill yet. So in total, the supplementals, if you're kind of considering what this body's already passed, what this body did not put forward with the idea that the Senate perhaps would put them forward, and then the capital supplementals expected from the governor, that would spend $174.9. So leaving you with $100,000 surplus in FY24. You'd think that's cutting it really close, but remember that additional revenue would go to the energy relief. So if revenue comes in low, that'll just reduce energy relief. If it comes in high, it'll increase energy relief. It's pretty certain at this point, with, you know, a couple months left in the year, that revenue, unless it falls off a cliff, that it'll be sufficient to make this budget. Really, any swing in revenue will just affect the size of that energy relief. So cutting it this close to $100,000 is not really a problem. Like, normally, if you had a budget that balanced by $100,000, I'd say that's cutting it really close. But I think because you have that energy relief that can go up and down, that risk isn't really there. But essentially, the House has kind of allocated the entire FY24 surplus that, you know, was $578 million before any of this, somewhere or the other, to either supplementals or energy relief. So,
Lexi, can we pause here? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair, through the co-chair. Mr. Painter, with your explanation about how the surplus, really shouldn't be that worried about it based on the circumstances that are likely to come before us. Historically, in your recollection, have we ever come to that level of a surplus in the past in relationship to this kind of situation? In other words, have we ever done this that low of a number before?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's fairly unusual to not have access to our savings accounts. Normally, when we've had a potential for deficit, we'd say, well, if there's a deficit, we'll fill it from X. There's no money left in the statutory budget reserve. We don't have access to the CBR because that vote did not succeed for FY24. So we don't have a deficit filler. That's fairly unusual historically. Usually we'd either leave a buffer or have an account that's a deficit filler. Using this energy relief appropriation as our deficit filler, sort of as our swing piece, is fairly unusual. Really, it's only the last couple of years that we've seen budgets where there's been something like an energy relief check or potential forward funding or some item that is in the budget and could scale up if the revenue is available, but it could also scale down if it's not. And that, in FY23, that's sort of that forward funding appropriation. The idea when we passed the budget was that if we had extra revenue in FY23, it would go to forward funding education. If we didn't, that appropriation would go away. When oil did drop even more than expected last year, the legislature came back and got a CBR vote for FY23, rather than just relying on forward funding as the swing piece. So it's kind of a different way to build a budget, but I think it's in response to the difficulty in obtaining CBR votes the last few years. The legislature has not relied on savings and instead had sort of appropriations that can scale up and down instead.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Painter, I want to just be clear and sort of get this on record if I can. First of all, there's the cynical piece, cynical toward no particular person, but if we spend from supplemental, then people in political work can have sort of bragging rights that perhaps they've reduced the next fiscal budget for whatever value that has. But am I right that part of the reason we want to eliminate any surplusage, any surplus money in FY24, is that if we don't, it will lapse into the general fund and by constitutional provision go into the CBR, and then we sort of lost opportunity there. Is that the best reason, assuming you don't care about restoring the CBR? And you've got bills to pay. Is that the best reason to look back or to stay in the current fiscal year and spend it down?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so that's one of the reasons for sure. The legislature tried a couple of years ago putting the surplus into the statutory budget reserve as a majority spendable account. The governor vetoed that appropriation. It ended up in the CBR where we had to obtain a three-quarter vote to get it back out. The other reason is that we have a lot more certainty about revenue in FY24 than FY25. The fiscal year is almost over. It would take wild swings in revenue not to have some revenue available. FY25 prices could, who knows where we'll be in a year. So, one of the things, the way you kind of budget with oil price volatility, at least that we've kind of historically, or I've kind of encouraged the legislature to do, is think about building your budget conservatively for the current year, and then if there's extra money, you can spend it in supplemental. If there's not enough, then you don't have to go back and cut at the end of the year. So if you kind of budget conservatively in the upcoming year, you can always go back and spend that in the supplemental, but it's much harder to cut in the supplemental. So I think that philosophy of having a conservative budget going forward and then, that being available for spending the next year is kind of what you're seeing driving some of the supplementals, at least in the Senate side, being in the previous year.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Very good.
Okay, so I'll move on to FY25. So this is a slide that's just trying to figure out how do we get from the budget we all received on actually December 14th. They delivered it one day early, but still the due date, December 15th, the budget submitted by the governor, to what the House passed. So first, the governor had a series of amendments on the amendment deadline that increased the UGF operating budget by $30.9 million. I guess, so he started with $4,676.6 million as his FY25 UGF operating budget. Added amendments that increased by $30.9 million on February 14th. Added additional amendments on March 13th, adding another $2 million. So the governor's amended budget, as of the time the House was working on the budget, was about $4.7 billion. He's since submitted a couple other amendments that were not in time for this body to consider that I'll talk about later. In subcommittee, the House subcommittees actually collectively reduced the operating budget by $7.3 million. The Finance Committee then increased it by over $250 million. The largest of that was the outside the formula funding for education, about $175 million. That's by far the majority of that addition coming out of this committee. The House floor added another $20.5 million in FY25 items to arrive at a total budget, UGF operating budget. Again, this is pre-PFD of $4,974.5 million. So just about $300 million over the governor's budget, again, or governor's original budget. And again, the largest addition of that was that outside the formula funding passed in this committee. So the House's budget, operating only again, start with agency operations, about $4.6 billion, statewide items, $393 million. Permanent fund dividend was $1.1 billion, and then we have fund transfers of $5.3. Those are below the line, but for simplicity, I'm including them here. So in total, the House budget, before considering a capital budget and before considering things that aren't in the bill yet, just what's in the bill right now, leave $368.7 million as a potential surplus in FY25. So again, that's just what was in the versions of House Bill 268 and House Bill 270 that constitute the operating budget that this committee passed. So, again, before we get to other things, capital, et cetera, 368.7 is our starting point. So there's a lot of things that aren't in the bill yet. Should I pause the question?
No.
So the first is the governor on April 9th added some other amendments totaling $1.2 million of UGF for FY25 as well as the supplementals. Those were received while this body had already drafted floor amendments, so they weren't considered in this body. Some of them were added in the Senate's first CS to the operating budget, with other ones they plan to consider at a later date. The next category of items would be fiscal notes. So those are typically added by the conference committee. As the Section 2 of the operating budget, so Section 1 is the regular operating item, Section 2 is fiscal notes, that will get added contingent on the bill's passing. So there's one bill, the broadband bill, that has been signed by the governor that has a $39.4 million fiscal note. So that at this point, the bill has been enacted. There's not really a contingency, but if it's we can still stick it in the fiscal note section, that would add $39.4 million that's not currently in the operating budget. The other largest bill that's out there that seems likely to pass is the senior benefits extension. That's a $23.5 million fiscal note. I looked at, as of a couple of days ago or last Friday, what bills have passed at least one of the two bodies and have a UGF fiscal note. I counted $14.5 million of UGF fiscal notes, and that's both that's operating capital, and there's actually a little supplemental in there, but just for simplicity, I'm kind of putting it all in one category. There's other bills that are still working their way through the finance committees that might pass. There are some of these bills that may have passed one body that won't pass. But when the conference committee is considering how do we build a fiscal note packet, they're trying to figure out which bills are likely to pass because they often have to assemble that before all of the action on the floor is done. So right now, our placeholder would be about $14.5 million. I would expect that that would increase over time because most of the bills that we see in one finance committee or the other are adding to the budget. We see very few that are taking away from the budget. So most likely that number would go up unless there's some bills that appear to lose momentum and potentially go away. There's also not considering revenue impacts of bills because some of those it's a little unclear exactly what's built into the forecast and what's not. So we don't always consider that at this point when we're just talking about what's adding to the budget. The next item is that there's four unions that are currently negotiating new contracts. The statutory deadline for those is the 60th day of the legislative session. However, that is rarely met. They can be added all the way up through conference committee. Sometimes they're added by the conference committee, and usually they're added in the other body because of timing. There's three units that are negotiating extensions that have existing contracts that are negotiating new contracts at the supervisory unit, the correctional officers, labor, trades, and crafts. There's also a new Alaska graduate student union. There's a statutory tie between the supervisory unit and the exempt employees. So when we passed a bill a couple of years ago to increase the salaries of exempt employees, there was language in there that said that the exempt employees' salaries should be tied to the supervisory unit going forward so that they're moving in tandem. And if those salary increases are applied to the exempt employees, that increases the impact. So with the new graduate student union, we don't really have much basis to figure out what a potential cost of that would be. I did look at the three units. If they just agreed to a 5% increase, that's a placeholder number. We estimate the UGF cost to be at least $26 million. Our understanding is that the high end of those negotiations is much, much higher than 5%. That's just kind of the low estimate, so you have something to build on. We have not seen those contracts come in yet. We're getting down to the last few weeks of session, so we'll see. They may not even come in this year if they don't come to agreement soon, but that's kind of the bottom line, or the lowest number we could see coming forward would be that $26 million.
Okay, first place to pause, Representative Galvin, Josephson.
Thank you, through Chair Etchman. Thank you very much, Mr. Painter. I have a question, two of them. One is of the line item that says passing one body, the $14.5 million. Does that include SB 88? Was that part of your?
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, no. That bill came out of the Senate Finance Committee with a negative fiscal note based on old actuarial information. There is a new fiscal note forthcoming on based on newer actuarial information. At this point, I've just excluded it because there are not new fiscal notes with that newer actuarial information, and that bill has not made it to the Finance Committee where they would be able to attach that. So at this point, it's excluded.
Thank you. And one more on that. Did that include House Bill 89? That's the child care bill that passed the House.
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, yes. That's the majority of the House's share of that, the bills that have passed the House that have a fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Co-Chair Edgman, I have one more question, if I may.
One more.
Thank you. This is around the salary adjustments for four unions. I just wanted to be clear that the $26 million does not include the 500 Alaska graduate student union members. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, that's correct. Since they don't have a contract, we don't really know what that could look like in the first year.
Through the Chair, if I may, and this is about this particular question because I think it's important for us to note that the 26 is the very, very bottom floor, but it does not include these 500 students. And my understanding is there's been a little bit of research in knowing what other states, for example, have done, and we could perhaps extrapolate from that, which helps us to understand that we're looking at least probably 5 to 10 million. And so I just wanted to make sure we're all aware of that.
Through the Chair, Representative Galvin, yes. So I looked at other, they're under the umbrella of the UAW, although it's, auto workers doing as grad students. But if you look at other states, the graduate students that are unionized do make substantially more than the non-unionized ones. So if you plugged in that, these are students who are working 10 to 20 hours a week, so it's part-time, 500 employees. If you plug in $10,000 or $20,000 more a year per each of those students, you'd get to that $5 or $10 million figure. It's hard to guess what other benefits they may be asking for or other terms other than salary or how it could be phased in. So I really have no way of putting a number that I'd feel confident in. I've not seen recent updates on their bargaining that shows what the positions are in that particular negotiation.
Representative Josephson.
Sticking with that theme through the chair, I thought I'd heard that the graduate students who are represented, interestingly, by the United Auto Workers, that some of the R1 monies were meant to go to them, since it was sort of PhD related. Did you know anything? I mean that might lower the number if it's true, since we've separately funded that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So the part of the R1 money is to additional stipends and pay for graduate students. It's unclear how those two things might intersect, whether it would be if they're just providing more students with stipends, that then providing larger stipends wouldn't necessarily do it, versus are they providing larger stipends? I haven't seen information from the university that sort of clarifies exactly what the plan would be.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, so the next item on here is the Federal Education Maintenance of Equity Requirement. I think you've probably heard about this. The federal government believes that the state of Alaska owes school districts amounts based on a maintenance of equity requirement attached to some COVID funds. The federal department believes that the state owes $11.9 million to districts for FY22 shortfalls, $17.5 million total across FY22 and FY23. Our state Department of Education has disputed those numbers, and the governor's not yet requested an appropriation. I'm plugging it in here because it's an item that is in the other body's budget at this point, and there's some desire to pay it despite the State Department not necessarily agreeing. So $11.9 million would be the amount to meet the FY22 shortfalls identified by the federal government going to two districts. They've identified FY22 as kind of a more time sensitive than FY23, although federal staff I've talked to have made it clear they would like us to pay both. Those would go to individual school districts, not to the federal government. It would be additional amounts to those districts. This does not include any Senate additions to the operating budget. Again, we're just kind of using the House. Historically, we've often seen that in conference committee, the result comes in higher than either body's budget because a lot of times they settle on taking a higher number in some cases. And it does not include a capital budget at all, so that 368 was before the capital budget. So if we're just totaling these things up on this slide, that would be $116.5 million of potential additions that we could see that are not in this bill yet in the operating side that we may see through fiscal notes or other items. Okay, so repeating that little fiscal summary, again, our $368.7 million surplus based on just the operating budget this body already passed. We add those 116.5 kind of placeholders for other future items. You're left with $252.2 million for a capital budget. If you'll recall, the governor's capital budget ended up being, I think 292 was the post-amendment number, a bit down from the older number, because he had some amendments that moved projects over. So that's not enough to fund the governor's capital budget or the other body's capital budget, based on kind of where we are now with those potential additions and then the operating budget this body passed. And I'll just get to the next slide before questions if it's because I'm just kind of building it sequentially. So if you add the Senate capital budget, again, this is before any House additions, there was $27.9 million remaining in FY24. That's the governor's supplementals. So if you add the Senate capital budget with supplementals, the House would be short $165.1 million in FY24. You add the Senate capital budget for FY25, the House would be short $3.6 million. So that's before any potential additions by the House. You'd be short in the neighborhood of $170 million. If you added another $100 million, you'd be short somewhere in the neighborhood of $270 million. Based, again, on the budget you already passed, plus the potential additions that I identified a couple of slides ago.
To put that into perspective, $270 million shortfall, that gets us to the $550 million UGF capital budget. Is that correct?
Co-chairman, yes, that's correct. Actually, I should correct myself. That gets to $100 million over the Senate's capital budget. They actually slightly underspent the 450 target, so I think that gets you to a $544 million capital budget, or $546 million if you do math.
Well, if I might.
Representative Josephson, I can see the wheels turning.
This is a bit like a Monopoly game, and I'm trying to figure out where the instruction manual is. The House last year, pretty arguably, or inarguably, passed an unbalanced budget. And this year, at least on paper, passed a balanced budget. So unless we find cuts in this committee with this bill, because we don't have any other appropriation budget to cut from, then we would be giving to the conference committee. Well, we would be sending an unfunded capital budget to the floor. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Jefferson, or you could draw from savings. But yes, either the conference committee would have to find reductions between the two bodies' budgets. And there are plenty of conferenceable items where you could get to that point, depending on how the other body's budget shakes out. And then the other alternative would be to draw from reserves.
Follow up.
So we've spent the reserve. So you're talking about the CBR?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Representative Ortiz?
And for a little bit more follow-up along the line of questioning, the concept of being down potentially 260, is that what you just said? Does that include then any – doesn't include any headroom going into the next year either, does it?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, right. That would be just completely getting to zero.
Okay, thank you.
I'll go to Representative Stapp and then Representative Josephson.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Excuse me, Edmund, my bad. Of course, I have it there, you know. Through the chair to Director Painter. Do you have a slide deck, Director? You probably don't have to do this, but at some point, how many of these projects that are funded in the budget got vetoed by the executive, you know? Do we know what the dollar amount was? I mean, some of these projects in the budget were actually in the budget last year, and they all got vetoed out, so... Curious if you have just a ballpark number, maybe.
Through the chair, Representative Sab, I don't know which of the projects that are in this year have been previously attempted and vetoed.
Okay.
Bring that information back to the committee. That's all.
The governor did administer vetoes to some of the maintenance lists in the FY24 budget, with items that are reappearing now in the FY25 budget proposal. And I don't have an idea what the number would be, and I don't even remember offhand what those vetoed amounts were, but the total vetoes in the FY24 budget were like $350 million range, something like that, $300
million. Chair Edgman, the UGF vetoes for FY24 had been about $200 million. I'm not sure about the all funds number, but it was right around $200 million was the total.
Representative Josephson, sorry.
Through the chair. So Mr. Painter, if we take up amendments and they are capital items that are not decrements or deletions, but every $1,000 we spend is money we need to cover in some way. Correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, whether coming from the operating budget, conference committee actions, or coming from savings.
Not that this would be an easy thing to do, but the House has already taken a position on the permanent fund dividend. Can it use this vehicle to reduce the permanent fund dividend, notwithstanding what we've passed in the operating budget?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it'd be difficult to have the capital budget amend something that's in the operating budget. I would note that the other body's operating budget has a different number, so that would be conferenceable. It also has a different method of paying the permanent fund dividend, so the entire PFD is conferenceable. Because the other body directed the entire percent of market value draw to the general fund and then paid the PFD out of the general fund. This body split the POMV draw between the general fund and the dividend fund. So that entire PFD is a conferenceable item. It's not limited to the difference between the two. So the conference committee would have that entire space to make changes on that particular item.
At some point, Chairman Edgman, I assume, will call for an amendment deadline. And unless we're offering amendments to cut a couple hundred million dollars, we will be sending an unbalanced capital budget to the floor. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Dobson, depending on the timing, my understanding of the planned timing, yes, you'd be sending it to the floor before the conference committee has begun its work. So, yes, you'd be sending it to the floor, not knowing exactly what the conference committee would do to create the space for the capital budget.
I can't think of a hearing I'd look less forward to than the one you described. Thank you.
Additional comments, questions around the committee table? If not, I think that brings us to the end of your presentation.
Oh. That's fine.
Maze of papers that I have here in front of me. Somewhere is the directions for the transition and getting us out of here. So basically, that concludes our business for today. Our next meeting will be tomorrow, Tuesday, April 23rd at 10 a.m., where we will be hearing House Bill 19, registration of boats, exemptions, House Bill 223, tax and royalty for certain gas, House Bill 202, opioid overdose drugs in schools. That will be its initial hearing. And seeing no further business from the committee and no microphones raised, we are adjourned at 3:07 p.m.